Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Eastern European Studies. I'm Kimberly St. Julian Varnin, the host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Dr. Anna Müller about her new book, If the Walls Could Speak, Inside a Women's Prison in Communist Poland. Anna, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
I'd like to begin with you telling us a little bit about yourself.
Myself. Okay, let me think. I was born in Gdańsk, Poland, which is the very north end of Poland. And I began my education there. I got two masters there. I got a master in history and political science, and then decided to travel west to look for some other opportunities to study somewhere else outside of Poland. So for a year, I studied in Geneva, Switzerland, at the School of International Studies, Graduate School of International Studies. And after a year in Geneva, Switzerland, I actually received a fellowship at Notre Dame University in South Bend, Indiana. So I spent the following year at Notre Dame. And there at Notre Dame, I learned about the possibility of me actually applying for a graduate school in the state, which I did, and started my graduate school in Bloomington University of Indiana University in 2003. And at some point there, I think it was 2007, when I left Indiana, left Bloomington for Poland to begin my dissertation, first pre-dissertation research, and then my dissertation research that led me to this topic to explore a prison cell of the Stalinist post-war, post-1945 prisons in communist Poland.
Interesting. So how did you get into your research in, you know, post-war communist prisons?
The topic of my dissertation initially was very different. I was very interested in studying the lives of women of solidarity. As you probably know, the 1980s in Poland witnessed this mass outburst of social engagement that culminated in the emergence of solidarity that helped somehow contributed to the fall of communism. So I was very much, this was the topic of my dissertation. I was really fascinated with this form of activism and decided to do my dissertation on these women. So in 2006, I think, 2007, one of my first pre-dissertation research summers in Poland, I met with a number of these women all over Poland. I interviewed them. I still have a big collection of the interviews with them. And I liked the stories I was receiving, but I felt that there was something that I was missing. There was some kind of a wall between me and this woman that I wasn't able to break through. And I guess now I understand the situation, that the the, not discouragement, but sort of reluctance to talk to me about some of the issues better than I did back then in 2006. But anyway, I decided to maybe interview the women activists of earlier generations. I decided to go back a little bit to the post-war activism and reflect on their role in, you know, Polish modern post-war history. And one night, one evening, I was invited to this dinner of a solidarity activist who invited her aunt for dinner, Jadwiga Niszowska. And Jadwiga turned out to be a former Stalinist prisoner who received a death sentence that was subsequently actually to a life sentence. She was imprisoned in 1952. And in 1956, her sentence was changed to 12 years, and she was released in 1958. So I spent an evening with her, and she didn't want to talk to me at all. From the very beginning, she kept telling me that I absolutely am not in a position to understand her story. That nobody can understand what this woman went through.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think she felt that no one could understand her experience?
I think she actually never sort of made it in freedom after she left prison. Her family left. Her father, I think, died when she was in prison. I remember well, it was either her father or her mother. Her sisters never came back to Poland after the war. They left Poland towards the end of the war with the Polish armed forces in the West. Jadwiga actually traveled to England, where she started architecture. Her sister went to England and never came back. And Jadwiga missed her parents and her family so much that she returned. And I think she, for the rest of her life, she regretted this moment of return and her involvement in anti-communist organization that she perceived as a little bit sort of crossing a lot of boundaries. They were involved in some assassination of the communist officials. And after she was released from prison, she had really hard time finding a job. She never married. She actually fell in love with a man in a prison cell. There's a beautiful poem of her engagement to a man she met in a prison cell, but he left earlier and they never met again. So I think she was, I think she was emotionally broken, and she never recovered. She never managed to finish her studies that she began before her imprisonment. She managed to get a good job. She never married. My guess is that she, for the rest of her life, she actually missed the man she loved. So she was very bitter. She was very unhappy and very bitter. And then I showed up, and I wasn't the first person that interviewed her, but I was one of the first people that were interviewing her, because for years she refused to talk about her experience because it was too much. It was too difficult, because her prison didn't end after she left the prison cell. Like, she didn't cross the Rubicon, as one of the other women said, it's like the imprisonment in a sense continued. The sense of confinement continued after she left prison. In a sense, almost she was more free in a prison cell than she was after she left the prison cell. There were almost more limitations for her. So she was very bitter and just not ready to give me a right to understand her story. But there was something in her. There was this very deep sadness. There was there was something in her story that pulled me in immediately. I think the depth with which she was talking about her experience, something in her eyes, that made me go for it, even though she said, "Don't even try." And over time, we became friends. I visited her many times. We spent a lot of hours of talking. I didn't record her that much because she didn't like being recorded. She didn't like talking about it. But over time, we became friends. And I actually called her after I finished my dissertation, after I defended, I moved from Poland to the United States in 2012, and I called her for Christmas. Before Christmas, I think it was 2011. And she told me, she was again very, very sad. And she said, don't call again. I'm saying goodbye. And she literally died a couple of months later after our phone conversation. And this was our last phone conversation. Yeah, it was,
there was
something in her voice. There was this, the way she pronounced it, the way she commanded me not to call her again, because this is it. She's not going to continue living anymore. And she died. I think I checked online a couple of months later, and yeah, she was not with us anymore. So that's with her, really, the entire project started. After I managed to meet with her a couple of times, after I managed to get her, to convince her to talk to me, she put me in touch with some of her friends, because it turned out she had a big network of friends from prison. A lot of these women created those like very dense networks of former prisoners. So even though this was a very difficult time for them, they act post prison life was oriented, was centered around their prison friends and the networks they develop in prison.
So Jadwiga is kind of she's the impetus for the project. So could you tell us a little bit about these women? So what generation are most of these women from?
So there are three different generations of women. I was able to interview only two generations. The oldest generations were the women that were born in the 1880s, so the end of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. The youngest generation were the women that were born just before the Second World War. The oldest group, the women that were born at the turn of the century, really represent a minority. I didn't manage to talk to any of them. In a couple of cases, I managed to talk to their friends or their cellmates. I guess I can put it that way. The biggest group constituted mm-hmm. women that were born in the 1920s. So they were born already in independent Poland. Poland regained independence after the First World War. And these women were really the first generation of women born and educated in independent Poland in the 1920s, early 1920s to late 1920s. And during the Second World War, they got very actively engaged in the anti-Nazi resistance. And for many of these women, their engagement, their activity continued in the years just after the war. The youngest generation are so-called children of the mm-hmm. war, were the women born in the 1930s, who really towards the end of the war were in their teenage years. So they were essentially coming out of age at the end of the war. So Jadwiga Janiszowska was one of them. She was very young when the war was ending. Mm-hmm. She participated in the Warsaw Uprising, and then she was taken out of Warsaw after the Warsaw Uprising failed to an Auflag for women. And from there, she actually traveled to Italy and from Italy to England.
Wow. So it encompasses three generations of women. So would you say that the war is a defining experience for the later two generations, more so than the first generation who were born in the 1880s?
That's a great question, because I feel that for many of these women, war was a defining experience. War was one of the defining experiences, because I think it was the prison that was really the defining experience.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I say it is that the war and war activism led them to prison, because they were essentially in prison for what they did during the war. But they continued their life after their release from prison. And the majority of them were released between 1953 and 1956. And their life really having in mind everything that happened to them in prison, with the people counting on help of the women that they met in prison. They were helping each other to get a job, mm-hmm. to support them, each other emotionally. They were replacing their families. So in a sense, mm-hmm. prison was this essential experience for them that defined the rest of their lives. So yeah, it's kind of tricky because it's the war, but also the post-war years, the prison years, they were crucial in their cases.
Going into how these women would become criminals, because in chapter 2 of your book, you talk about the imbalance between in power between the interrogator and the criminal. Could you speak to that for the listeners about how you delve into that aspect in the book?
Yes. My intention, I really didn't want to base this entire dissertation. It started as a dissertation, so I didn't want to base the entire dissertation later book on only oral interviews or the documents that I was able to find in private archives. So the Polish Institute of National Remembrance holds a number of documents that relate to political prisoners from this time period. But really, the only thing that they have are those interrogation files, right? And sometimes those interrogation files are hundreds of pages long. So in some cases, you're dealing with 900, even longer interrogation files that are usually typed, difficult to read, very sometimes tedious, asking this woman what they did on a particular day, and then interrogation ends, and then there is another interrogation 3 days later, asking almost exactly about the same things, right? So I guess what happened is that I kept going through those very, very long interrogation files, and my first impression was like, wow, I have no idea how to read it. So this was this moment when a historian looks at the historical documents and has no idea how to deal with that, right? First of all, everything that was happening in that room is not recorded there. So the violence is recorded, how tired, how exhausted, how scared these women are, or men for that matter, is not recorded. How the room in itself is already an object, a tool of violence. None of this is there. So you get this very polished transcript of a conversation, and conversation really of a kind of a dialogue. And at first I didn't even know that it is possible this is actually a dialogue, right? How much space these women have to maneuver trying to figure out whether there's anything that they can do about their situation. Is there a way that they can improve their predicament? After a number of conversations with this woman, I realized that what they were doing in a conversation with me was, in a sense, they were repeating the interrogation, in a sense. They were telling their stories, and I was giving them a lot of freedom to tell their stories, and they were, in a sense, repeating the interrogation. They were asking the questions that their interrogators asked. And they were almost putting me in a position of the interrogator, this 50 years later, right? Trying to, A, narrate the story, but the people who sort of framed this narration were the interrogators that they met 50 years earlier. And B, I think they were trying to understand, similarly to me, what exactly happened in this particular moment. So after seeing these two things somehow working in tension or not working at all, I decided to just stop interviewing people and just look at the files again, trying to figure out whether there is to actually reconstruct the voices and reconstruct the struggle that is happening in an interrogation room. So again, I gave the reader first the background to telling a little bit about the violence that is happening there, a little bit about the historical circumstances, and then trying to read very closely three cases of interrogation protocols. Before going into the interrogation protocols, the transcripts themselves, I tried to add a little bit to the context by telling about the different strategies that the women could have employed. Some of them did employ them. Some of them talked about this potentiality that they could have, for example, play a role of, you know, a weak woman or somebody who is able to flirt with interrogation officer or is responding. Actually, those tools were used by both sides because interrogation officers also sometimes, you know, try to flirt with the women in order to get the information they needed. They were threatening them with the life or safety of their loved ones. And after that, I actually tried to reconstruct those three cases of three different women, Barbara Otwinowska, Felicia Wolf, and Stanisława Sowińska. And they are three very different women. Barbara Otwinowska represented the second generation of women who were involved in the Home Army, participating in the Warsaw Uprising, and then felt like they were not ready to give up arms after the war. And she continued some kind of political activity. And she really tried to maneuver during her interrogation. She was presenting herself as somebody who was trying to help her cousin because she loved him. She couldn't really understand what's going on. So she was, in a sense, playing a role of a victim, of somebody who did not quite understand the seriousness of everything she was getting involved in. And I spent many, many hours talking to her. Because later on in life, she actually established the Association of Fordonianki, the Women Political Prisoners. So at some point in her life, she was the head of all the activities that aimed at commemorating these women. She died very recently, a month or so ago. And she told me a lot about what was going on in her interrogation protocol. And my sense was that she felt a little guilty, that she, with the times passed, she realized that she was just, that her family and her were trying to get her out of her predicament by suggesting that she can play a role of, you know, somebody who is weak, potentially somebody who is not mentally too stable and needs some external support. The other woman, one of my favorite was Anna Neumann or Felicia Wolf. She actually was using two different names. Her friend, she was an elderly woman who was involved in the First World War. Then she was a trained soldier during the interwar time period. Then she was very much involved in the Second World War. And after the war, she was actually helping people to cross the borders illegally to Western Europe. She was arrested twice. The first time when she was arrested, the people who arrested her didn't recognize who she was. They were looking for her. And yeah, the way she played her role, they were not able to figure out who she was because she had different documents. She was presenting herself as older. She looked older. She had two different names. And until the very end, she kept changing her testimonies, giving, she had two or three different versions that she was providing her interrogators with, depending on the circumstances. And until the very last moment, she kept telling them that she's not the person they think she is. I call her eternal conspirator because she was conspiring to the point that when I finally look at her case, I still wasn't quite sure who she was. And there's a beautiful story related to her that some of her friends told me later in her life because she left prison and she was very lonely, surrounded by some of her prison friends. She didn't really have a family of her own. And she lived with a family of one of her prison cellmates. And at some point when she was an elderly woman, and the anti-communist opposition started in the 1970s and then continued through the 1980s, she was already bedridden. So her place, her apartment, her room served as a place where opposition members were, for example, leaving a lot of oppositional leaflets, illegal brochures. And her door was always open because she was bedridden. So people had to come and go and not bothering her, not making her get up from bed to open the door. So her door was always open. At some point, police came in and they started looking for those illegal documents. And she, you know, was again playing a role. She played a role of this very senile person who does not quite know what's going on around her. And she told the police officers, militia, I don't know, there are people coming in and out. I have no idea what's going on. So they found all her on her desk some leaflets, confiscated them, and left, right? The truth is that the majority of the important documents were actually underneath the mattress that she was sleeping on, right? So the entire time she knew what was going on, it's just that she was sleeping on a mattress that covered, that was hiding a lot of these documents that she didn't want to reveal, and she never revealed that.
That's fascinating. So these women, you talk about them after prison, they have these networks of their fellow political prisoners. So do these relationships that they build, that they have outside of prison after they've left, do you see these being formed while they're in prison? Were they this close while they were in cells together? Or is it something that forms after they've been released from prison?
I think they were formed inside and after. That was one of my problem, because every time I talked to this woman, they were so positive about every single relationship that developed in prison that it almost felt like it's just too idealized, that they just don't remember the details well. There's something they don't get. And I was trying to give the reader a sense that I really don't have negative stories. I'm not saying they don't exist. I just don't have them. So sometimes another type of documents that I was using a lot are prison cell protocols. I'm sorry, prison spies protocols. So each cell had a prison cell implanted in it. And those cell spies were very often potential conflicts, right? But I went through a number of those reports, and there's very little about them arguing with each other, right? There is from time to time they talk about conflicts between political criminal prisoners. There was usually a big class difference between this woman too. I also noticed that some of these reports also talk about how these women political prisoners were sometimes trying to turn the conflict into a life lesson that they were giving to the criminal prisoners. So there is that sort of class tension that existed between them. But what I wanted to say is that one of my favorite stories, absolute favorite stories, and that's a little related to my next project, is the story of a cell where you have two home army women, so two anti-Nazi, anti-communist women, and in the same cell you have two communist women, women who were pro-communism. One of them was Jewish, one of them was not Jewish, who were very much involved in building communism after the war. And they both got imprisoned in this communist sort of witch hunt that started in the 1948. One of them was imprisoned, Eva Pivinska was imprisoned when she worked for the Polish embassy in Paris, and the Polish government sent her to a different embassy in Rome. So she came to Warsaw. She had a daughter at this point, and she actually had two children. She had an older daughter that she left with her parents in Warsaw, and she boarded a train with her 3 weeks old daughter that was born in Paris in order to go to Rome. And while she was almost crossing the border, the train was stopped and she was arrested with her daughter. She was imprisoned in the cell with these two home army women. She doesn't know what's happening with her daughter. She's definitely pro-communist. Another woman in the cell is Tonia Lechtman, a Jewish woman who left Poland with her family for Palestine in 1934. In 1939, she traveled to... In 1938, I'm sorry, she traveled to Spain, where she was supposed to fight for the international brigades. She traveled with her husband. They go to Paris. From Paris, they're supposed to travel to Spain. In the meantime, she gets pregnant. So her husband travels to Spain while she stays in Paris. And then from Spain, he gets sent to Auschwitz, where he dies in 1945, right? But towards the end of the war, when Tonia plans on returning to Poland with her, at this point, already two children, because at some point she went to Spain to visit her husband, show him their first daughter, and then she gets pregnant again. So by the end of the war, she has two children. So she travels back to Poland because she hopes that her husband is still alive. And then she learns that he actually died when during the death march out of Auschwitz in the beginning of the 1945. So she stays in Poland, gets involved into this activities of actually American activities, American help. Americans were trying to build hospitals in Poland for the war refugees. So she gets involved with Americans, is very pro-communist. She's very active, and in 1948, she's imprisoned. So at some point, you have these two women, these two communists, plus the two Home Army women, and one Ukrainian woman who is a member of the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, imprisoned in one cell. And for everybody who actually knows the context, the history, it's very difficult to expect this woman to actually create any kind of friendly bond. Because the Home Army were fighting with the communists, right? The communists don't really trust the Home Army, plus they don't really understand why they are in prison in the first place. And then there is this Ukrainian woman that is sort of thrown in between all four of them, and she's both anti-Polish and anti-communist. And we actually know a lot about what was happening in the cell because one of them... And I don't know who, but I have my guesses. One of these five women is writing, turns to be a spy, turns out to be a spy. And she's actually writing reports about the situation in this one cell. So she's telling us a lot about the conversation that these women were having, what they were talking about, who is more open towards communism and who is criticizing Stalin, for example, right? So this cell is actually evidence of incredible friendship that developed in those conditions where you would not expect, you know, any close, intimate bonds to develop. We don't know who was writing the reports. My guess is that was the Ukrainian woman. And the reason for that is because she is the only one who is not mentioned in the reports. But even if it's her... Her reports are very friendly. She really writes with a lot of understanding for all of them. She talks about these very motherly relationships that develop between them, how they, for example, were organizing protests together, so how they were helping each other, how they were supporting each other emotionally, especially for one of them, Eva Piwińska, who's very, very old, very, very small infant was, she didn't know what happened to her daughter. So she was really desperate. And the other woman really bonded and tried to help her. These relationships continued after the war, after they were released. They maintained correspondence throughout the 1960s and 70s. Tonia Lechtman, one of them, left Poland in 1968 for Israel. And Eva Piwińska and Halina Zakrzewska, the other anti-communist woman, kept visiting Tonia Lechtman in prison years later. We don't really know what happened to Vera, the Ukrainian woman. I don't think they stayed in touch. That's another reason why I suspect that she was a spy in the cell. But even if that's true, I think her report show respect that she had for everybody in the cell.
That's fascinating. So do the women know that there is a spy in the cell, or is this something you find out later in the archives? Do they have any suspicions that someone's spying on them?
They usually know. They usually know. Or if they don't know, they find out after some time. Plus, there are some names. There are some women who are well-known spies because they've been in prisons for long, and you know, the sort of information travels, and they know. And this is sort of passed from a cell to a cell. Supposedly, one of the signs that somebody's a spy were constant or often happening conversation with the prison administration. So it could be the reasons for any kind of conversation with the prison administration would be either an interrogation or some kind of informing job. So if these women were meeting with prison administration often, and if they're returning to their cells not exhausted or beaten up or hurt in the emotionally or distressed, that was very often a sign that they are engaged in some different kind of conversation. Because this was something that they knew, that almost each one of them was asked at one point or another to report on their cellmates. And I think a lot of them did, more than we think did that, and more than would like to admit that. But many of them were reporting on each other, basically just saying what was happening in this cell without being hostile, for example. Just reporting on the fears that they were having, right? How they worried about their families, how they worried about their husbands. Many women knew, and this is knowledge that many of them took out of their conspiratory activities during the war, that they are not supposed to be talking about a conspiracy or any kind of anti-communist activity, because walls have ears. So they knew that they're not supposed to be talking about it. Plus the more, and this is something that, you know, was part of the experience of the war, the more somebody else knows, the less they are safe, right? So for your own safety, you should not be talking about your past. So in a sense, the prison is the beginning where they are trying to reconstruct themselves and create new identities for themselves in separation, some kind of distance from everything that happened to them during the war and the identities that they developed during the war. There are a number of cases where they were finding out how distinguished some of the women were long, long after they release. This is a case of Irena Tomalak, who was really in prison recognized as a prison poetess. She was writing beautiful, beautiful, beautiful poems. I'm just trying to check here. And then after the war, after they were released, they actually realized that she was a soldier of the Polish military organization, and she was already active during the First World War. And then she was also very active in the military training of women during the interwar time period, and very active in the home army. She was very distinguished. And none of the women that were in cell with her knew about this when they were in prison. Irena Tomalak, who was just recognized as a poet. She was the one who actually wrote a beautiful poem about Jadwiga Janiszowska and her engagement in a prison cell. I don't know if we have a second. I can actually probably find this poem and read a fragment of it.
And so Jadwiga was the first woman you were discussing, the one who really didn't want to talk to you.
Yeah. Right. And she, at some point after, you know, really years of having a relationship, talking, she at some point just pulled out the letter from prison that she sent to her family. Oh, well, maybe it wasn't her letter. It was somebody else's letter, in which this poem that I will read in a second was recorded. And this was a poem that Tomalakova, Tomalak, Irena Tomalak, wrote to celebrate the third anniversary of their informal clandestine engagement with Jurek, a man who was in a different cell. And then they passed it outside of the, because in prison they were not allowed to write anything. So I think at some point later during the imprisonment, when she finally, Jadwiga finally received a pen and a piece of paper and was allowed to write a letter to her family, she wrote this poem, and that's how the poem left prison walls.
Yes.
Would you like me to read a fragment of it? There were no walls. There were no walks to take, no theater, no. Nobody waited with bread and salt in a doorway, a wall and cement instead of carpets, two separate cells instead of a wedding carriage. In no room did two hearts so strongly beat towards each other. It was a wedding. Gazing at the shadow of prison bars and kneeling in front of a wall, you promised, forever, through life and death, to march together and to love each other. And your Jurek promised as well. Today is your third anniversary. Although there are still no flowers and you're still apart, darling, yearning still waves through your common poem. But I know that soon the gate to freedom will open towards happiness. And he left earlier and they never saw each other again.
Oh, goodness. So they had this prison engagement for 3 years at least, and then he just left her.
Yes. 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 So the poem was sent to her family in 1954. So the engagement took place in 1951. She was released in 1957.
And so this kind of leads into the question, if these women weren't allowed to write in prison, how did they know or keep up with their families? So many of the women you talked about had small children when they went to prison. And so how does that affect their family and how does that affect them and their identities as mothers?
Yeah, so they were not allowed to write to their families during the interrogation part of the imprisonment. Once they were done with their interrogations, when they crossed that river, they were allowed to write to their families once a month. It, depending on a prison, there were different restrictions. So once a month, they were asked to take out their pens and papers. So they were receiving pens and papers and were sitting outside of a prison cell writing letters to their families. And this was the moment when, that's why I think the interrogation crossing, finishing interrogation is almost like a crossing a threshold, because they can renew after a trial, can renew, try to reconnect with your family. And that's the moment when you can start writing to your mothers, to your fathers, to your families, to your boyfriends, husband, lovers, and children. And some interrogations lasted up to 5-6 years. So it was often very, very dramatic, because many of these women left little children, and many of them were not able to reconnect with their children after they were able to keep writing. Part of the problem was the children very often didn't know who their mothers were. The grandparents were afraid to actually reveal that their parents are in prison, because this is a very politically tense time. So sometimes it's better for the children not to know that their parents are in prison. Some of the children, like the children, Vera and Marta Lechtman, the children of Tonia Lechtman, the one Jewish communist woman that I already mentioned, they were in an orphanage. And nobody really knew where they were. So it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy to communicate with them. I had a chance to look at a number of collections that contained letters of mothers to their children. So in some cases, you have stories of children that were, you know, in their early teens and were imprisoned with their mothers, released elderly. And then there's sort of, after this interrogation time period, when the mothers were finally allowed to start writing to them, they try to mother them. They try to be a parent from a distance, which is incredibly difficult. And it's really heartbreaking. They talk a lot about the constant they very often had with other women in a cell, what kind of advice they should be giving to their daughters and sons, how they can, you know, bridge the distance, the mental and physical distance that exists there. But this is probably one of the most difficult things that that they experienced. And I don't know whether this is a good moment to say it, but at the moment I'm teaching in prison, it's called Inside Out Prison Exchange class. And the class consists of 15 outside students, or students of University of Michigan Dearborn, and then 15 inside students, where it's the prisoners of the prison where we teach this class. And the thing that is a man who carries sometimes very long, sometimes life sentences, very long sentences. And one of the most tragic, most difficult part of imprisonment for them is the separation from their children.
Mm-hmm.
And this fear, they fear that since these children don't have a parent, don't have a father to help them grow, they may end up in prison as well because they are deprived of role models. And
did the so I'm just going off of that. Do the women, do they have that similar fear that their children?
That's exactly what I want to say. Exactly that they are afraid of depriving the children of having role models. So in their letters, they very often try to recreate those imaginary role models for them. They talk about their fathers that sometimes was long dead and the children never had a chance to meet them, or grandparents, or even themselves. Of course, all these letters are very censored, so there's very little they can say in the letters. So sometimes it's this very delicate walk that these women make in order to create kind of an imagined role model for their children, for their sons and daughters.
Mm-hmm.
To give them some kind of directions in how they should, hoping that they can affect somehow their early adulthood, or, you know, coming out of age. And there's a number of interviews recorded with, to hear the dog. It's a dog barking. Mm-hmm. Should I get rid of
that? No. Sorry. Oh, we're fine.
Okay, let me. I'll take her out, okay? Is that okay?
Okay.
You go. Okay, I'm back. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, you're fine.
Where was I? Okay. I know. So I talked to some of, but not many, of the children of the women prisoners. But there's a number of those records out there that I had access to. And many of them are still bitter about it. Because sometimes they see this distance that existed for years between them and their parents as consequence of their political engagement, right?
So that's interesting. So you have these women following, you know, the fall of communism in Poland, and it seems like they're celebrated because of their anti-communist stances, but their children aren't necessarily a part of that.
I think they were learning how to appreciate that, right? But that's started coming with time, because, you know, the 60s, 70s, and 80s are very difficult politically in Poland, and these women don't really talk about their experiences until late 90s, because they're very afraid of actually talking about everything that happened to them. So they're opening up very, very late in life. So children very often don't know what happened, what exactly they went through. The women are afraid of sharing these stories because they're afraid that the stories may be still dangerous and children in trouble, right?
Right.
Something is broken there. And it takes decades for this link to be revealed. And actually decades until people feel that they're ready to talk about this. And for many of these people, it's too late. because, you know, their mothers are gone or the distance between them is too great to be bridged.
That's fascinating. And so do you think that your book kind of helps those families? So if their parents or their mothers have passed away before they can talk about their experiences, do the other experiences of the other women kind of help them reconcile with the fact that their mothers or grandmothers also went through those experiences?
I think so. Although I have to say that when I started collecting the stories, many people already felt that it's actually that being sort of engaged in the anti-communist opposition is something that is elevating an individual on many, many levels. So it's a good question. I don't know. I would say I hope, maybe in some cases. I think maybe what helped is the fact that having a historian interviewing, probing you, asking you about your family is opening up some issues to new reflections. So maybe that's what's hopefully pushed some of them to think about their past and reopen some of the chapters of their life that they thought were closed. I don't know. I'm not sure I have an answer to this question.
And that's fine. It's one of those things where you have such an interesting research topic and interesting work, because most historians, we're dealing with issues that are kind of, they're settled. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily still involved in the cultural life of the country, but your topic is still very much involved in Polish cultural life. And so it's an ongoing and changing.
Yes, very much. Topic. Very much so, especially now. Yes, very much so. It's very true.
So Anna, we've taken about, you know, an hour of your time today. So to wrap up, would you like to tell us what are you working on now?
Yes, with great pleasure. So what I decided to focus on is I'm writing a biography of Tonia Lechtman, this communist Jewish woman who was imprisoned in Poland, partially because I learned a lot about her during my work on this book. Plus, I discovered this incredible collection of letters that she kept sending to her family from as I told you, she left Poland with her family in 1934. And one reason why she claims, at least, or she claimed because she died, that her family left Poland in 1934 was because she, Tonia, and her brother were getting too much involved with communism. So their parents were afraid that, you know, their Jewish children from good, relatively rich family of Łódź industrialists are getting too much into communism. So they left for Palestine. Then she traveled with her husband, a Russian Jew, to Spain. And from 1938, she kept sending letters to her family in Palestine, and then later Israel, throughout the entire war, from different places. So she has two Jewish children. She's hiding in Switzerland, in France, in different places in Europe, while sending letters to her family in Palestine. And this entire collection is preserved. So there's that part of her story, of her life story. And then there is the story of her involvement in communism when she returns to Poland with all this energy and actually decides to put her children in an orphanage because she's too involved with building New Poland, so she doesn't really have time for her children, and then gets imprisoned by the same communist regime that she was working so hard. And even though that happened, she still remained a communist and really leaves Poland only in 1968 when her children decided that they just cannot be in Poland anymore. Some of your listeners may be familiar with the movie, Polish movie directed by Bugajski, titled Interrogation. It's a movie about a woman, Tonia, who is a singer, a cabaret dancer. I don't remember the details of who she exactly is, but she is having an affair with secret police officer, and she gets imprisoned And she is hysterical in a prison cell. She cries, she screams, and she's sort of slowly becoming stronger and stronger in a prison cell. Some people claim that Tonya Lechtman, the Jewish woman that I am working on, is a model for the interrogation, the movie Interrogation, which I hope to find out more about it. But there are definitely some similarities between two Tonyas. Yeah, there's more.
That sounds like a fascinating project.
I hope so. I really find it fascinating. And yes, and I hope I have two chapters written, and I hope that this is something that I will be able to finish relatively fast, because the story has been with me for many, many years now. And I think I know it very deeply. And yeah, and I hope that it will be interesting to others as well.
Well, Anna, that sounds like a potentially movie that you have as a project. And I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. I think the listeners are going to love it. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you for having this conversation with me.